time, 2 weeks ago when we met, we shared a number of different voices from the labor and cultural Zionist perspective, which one is and one tends to be more to the left-wing side of the political spectrum. For those who are happy, tonight is a harder night. For those who are disappointed, tonight is pleasant. Because tonight we take a shift or a hard turn to the right. It all depends on how you look at it. And we share voices from the revisionist and the religious Zionist streams, the two streams of Zionist thinking that are understood to be, known to be, normally are more what is these days called the political right. So just a reminder for those for whom this may be their first session and who weren't able to join us virtually by listening to the recording of the session from 2 weeks ago, which is on the Temple website, and there will be a recording of tonight's session there as well. God willing, my phone is not behaving properly tonight, so if anybody's listening and then it's cut off later, my advance apologies. But I'm sure that the part of my phone that's malfunctioning was not invented in Israel. It was probably invented someplace else. I won't say exactly. Now, but a reminder of the structure of our classes, the readings that we're sharing and the thoughts to challenge our thoughts, as well as the additional experiences that I had to it, come from this really important new reference volume. It's called The Zionist Ideas, edited by Dr. Gil Troy, and it's a follow-up, it's a renewal of Arthur Hertzberg's The Zionist Idea, named in the singular, from the 1950s, which described streams in Jewish thought. And as I already mentioned in introducing tonight's conversation, tonight we'll be looking at different streams of Zionist thinking. But the book is organized, and I've organized the excerpts that we'll be focusing on in a particular way. In each of these streams, Dr. Troy has identified early voices, or pioneers, chalutzim, as he calls them, middle voices that he calls builders, those who've been part of the state. Many of the founding voices are in the pre-state era. Many of the builders are in the earlier or developing days of the states. And then he identifies in each of these areas what he calls torchbearers, which are much more recent voices that show new aspects of these schools of thinking about the whole issue of Zionism. And Zionism, in many ways, there are many different definitions of Zionism. Our last week, which is 2 weeks from today, there's one more stream that's discussed throughout the book, and that's what he calls political Zionism, which is just more sort of less ideological and more about the state and the idea of a state and its functioning. And since, as I've mentioned a number of times, I'm leaving this Thursday to go for a week of meetings with Israeli officials. We'll see how many officials actually meet with us, but we certainly have a meeting scheduled with the Prime Minister, who we'll be reading from today. That week will be organized 2 weeks from now slightly differently. For those who choose, and I hope many of you will, from 7 to 7:30 before the class starts, I'm very excited about the Israel trip that I'm leading for Temple next June. That focuses much more on security issues as well as social justice, which we always deal with. There's a meeting at 7 o'clock for those interested about our Israel mission that's coming up this June. From 7:30 to 8, I'm going to be sharing what information I can, my impressions of what it is that we asked of the Israeli leaders with whom we will meet, and how they responded, and what I think that indicates about the future of diaspora Israel-Jewish relations, because that's really the topic of the trip I'm participating in, is talking about the basis for and the ongoing hopes for the relatively difficult in the world today relations between Jews in the diaspora and Jews living in Israel. So, and then the last hour of the class will be structured like the class has been structured throughout, only looking at the political Zionist stream, because I think I'll have more to add about that stream, especially in a futuristic kind of a way, considering the meetings that I'm about to participate in. You'll be happy to hear that in truly Israeli fashion, you know, I'm leaving on Thursday, and many of the meetings we're having are, as of yet, unconfirmed. But it's far too early to get Israelis, let alone Israeli politicians, to commit to actual times for meetings. So they'll happen when they happen. But I will say that it will be interesting to see. I'm glad I'm doing the religious Zionist stream tonight, because and hopefully I made some other suggestions to the leaders of the trip. But currently, there are no meetings with Israeli religious establishment leaders on the trip. We're not meeting with anyone from the rabbinate. We're not meeting with any particular religious authorities. And when I questioned why it is that those meetings are not happening, it was suggested that if we ask for those meetings, it will lead to bad feelings when they refuse to meet with us. And that if they don't refuse to meet with us, it will lead to bad feelings because of the potentially unfortunate or insulting things would be said. Which I don't disagree with. I don't disagree with the statements. I only disagree with that as a premise not to have the meetings. I don't understand entirely why it is we're not requesting these meetings nonetheless. And I'll mention when we get into the later parts of the religious stream, some of the figures that I did suggest we meet with that we may or may not actually have meetings with. But it is part of the sad state of affairs in the relationships between Zionist Jews abroad and Israeli establishment and Israeli Jewish streams, that some meetings seem, even for a trip like this, are too difficult even to request, which to me, I think, shows a strain of diaspora politeness that may take away from this trip. I think we need to be civil with one another, but I think we have to be honest with one another as well. Interchange is only possible when people actually say honest things to one another. Hopefully, we can manage that and manage it somewhat respectfully as well. But we're going to go back to the beginning, as I said, and look first at the pioneers, the Chalutzim, those who helped bring these different ways of Zionist thinking into being. And the more right-wing or the revisionist school of Zionism, the original ideologue of revisionist Zionism is Zev Jabotinsky. And so I couldn't imagine that we could even consider this without having some words from the source, from where these things began. And again, as I noted, these are all excerpts from longer pieces. I want to at least take us through some of the readings that I chose for you from the pioneers in the revisionist and the religious streams, and then we'll have a little time to reflect on them, because we don't have time to do even most of it, let alone all. But I tried, again, hopefully you can see on the sheets that we're only going to be reading out loud here the sections that I have bracketed on the sheets there, right? So the first page says Zev Jabotinsky at the top, and it says it has number 69 at the bottom. And rather than too much description of the school, it's better to hear the words. And again, Beitar, which it's discussing here, Beitar is the youth movement of the revisionist school. And so this, they laid out a way of thinking about what it is that they're putting forward as the definition of their viewpoint. So when they say Beitarian, it really means revisionist. It's just, again, in Beitar, while it's also an abbreviation, the end of the second revolt against Rome that started in 135 of the Common Era was the destruction of Beitar. It was the last military response of the Jewish people, really, until Zionism in an organized way. When we were exiled much earlier and then came back to our land, and then the last attempt to maintain some kind of historical Jewish independence was the revolt against Rome in the a third of the way into the second century, around 135 of the Common Era. And at the end of that, Beitar, the destruction and the plowing of Beitar, its total destruction by the Romans, was the end of that. So there's also this idea that it is the renewal of Jewish strength and self-reliance, and when necessary, physical military organization and protection. So the name that we read here, when it says Beitarian, it's a revisionist way of thinking, but that's what's within that word. So the first paragraph that I noted here is number 2. And again, I'm going to read these not because you can't read, but so that people who might be listening to the recording also can get the flavor of what it is that we are discussing. So number 2, the Jewish state. The basis of the Beitarian viewpoint consists of one idea, the Jewish state. In this simple idea, however, lies a deep meaning indeed. What do the nations of the world symbolize? They symbolize that every nation must contribute its own share to the common culture of humanity, a share which is distinguished by its own specific spirit. For this purpose, every nation must possess its own laboratory, a country wherein the nation alone is master and can freely suit the common life in accordance with its own conception of good and evil. So the Jewish state, as you can hear from this perspective, from this particular Zionist viewpoint, is not about a political entity alone. It is stating loudly and clearly that for the Jewish people to continue to exist in a healthy and whole way, we need a place where we can fully realize ourselves and where Jews can live in a society that is formed in a Jewish manner, meaning that it becomes a laboratory for the spirit of the Jewish people, in the words that we have here. Now, you'll see there is no small amount of overlap between cultural Zionist ideas and these, depending on who was speaking, but these move in a different direction as well. But let's move down to number 4, the Hebrew language. Beitar recognizes Hebrew as the only and eternal language of the Jewish people. In Palestine, it must become the only language in all phases of life. In the diaspora, it must, at least, be the language of the Jewish educational system, starting with the kindergarten and ending with high school, later on perhaps college too, if we shall ever have Jewish universities in the diaspora. This again is a very strong statement. If you consider the distance between this philosophical perspective taken before the time of statehood and the reality of Jewish education around the world today now, and I have great respect for what we do here at Temple and for the Jewish day schools in the city and chat and everything else. When I came to Toronto over 25 years ago, at our community high school, at the time, as a matter of principle, all Jewish topics were taught in Hebrew. That's no longer the case. There have been quite a number of changes. And while there are many, and a strong population of Jewish students, the ability, even Toronto has one of the strongest day school systems in all of North America. And yet the level of spoken Hebrew here in the diaspora is relatively low compared to what it could be, or certainly compared to what's envisioned here. And as I've mentioned in some of my previous discussions, remember, this is without an Israel. An Israel where, to me, it's like the primary statistic in my way of thinking about Israel right now, where by now, more than 75% of the Jewish population of Israel were born in Israel and have lived their entire life in Hebrew. Many of them know English, but their English is not as good as it used to be, because so essential to their culture and to their worldview is that their language is Hebrew. And so the ability of Jews throughout the world to relate to one another, especially from this revisionist or Beitarian point of view, is strongly challenged by the fact that when the Israeli Jews interact with diaspora Jews, they don't do it in Hebrew. And so when we talk about, well, the world today has two big Jewish groups, mainly North America, the diaspora, but the vast majority in North America, and Israel, it's very hard to have a sense of mutuality and mutual respect if there's a sense that everything that we do together has to be done outside of the Hebrew language. It creates a sense that that's where Jewish culture is, and this is where Jewish culture isn't. I'm not saying that's the truth or the whole picture, but it's a mentality that's very important, and that the point of reading this is not that statistical reality, but that in these ideas, which are very, very salient ideas in Israel today, the streams that we're looking at, they're actually very much more strong in Israel today than what we looked at last week. That this is part of the ideological basis for some of these realities and views that have come about more recently. There's one more paragraph I want us to look at from this part. It's on the opposite side of the page there. It's not numbered, but it's talking about the relationship, well, it will between Judaism and the Jewish state. Talk about coordinating Zionism with other isms, other ways of thinking. And this paragraph says, this mixture, everyone see where I am? Yes? This admixture of various ideals, which Beitar absolutely rejects. That's like Judaism and Zionism and socialism together, or Zionism and capitalism together, or whatever it is about having balanced philosophies. This mixture of various ideas, which Beitar absolutely rejects, we may call biblically shatnez, which is a biblical prohibition of mixing two things that are totally different. The euphemistic stand of Beitar may be termed in Hebrew chadnes, one banner. Everything which disturbs the upbuilding of the Jewish state, whether in connection with private interests or with a group or class, must without preconditions bow to the one banner, to the command of the highest, the supreme ideal, to the Jewish state. So again, very clear, and we'll see further developments of this ideal. I don't want to just stick to one particular reading. But when people wonder sometimes, when they ask me questions about some of the stresses that we have between Zionist Jews here and Zionists in Israel today, I'm not saying this represents Israelis. Nothing represents Israelis, right? If the realm of discussion in Israel is this wide in the diaspora, then it's this wide in Israel. So nothing we say in any circumstance describes what Israelis think. Everybody has their own perspective and should. Nevertheless, the continuum as a whole has shifted to the right, and we wonder sometimes if there are statements that come out of Israel, especially from the current government, that we say, well, they make us uncomfortable because they don't seem to sit well with small L liberal Western values, right? Or the values of Western liberal democracy. It doesn't surprise me that many of the people making those statements would be very comfortable with these paragraphs. that they're not concerned about balancing those things, that there's a more unitary focus on what's good for the Jewish people and the Jewish state. Now, we'll reflect on all of these once we get a chance, but if you turn to the back of that page, I just want to share a couple of paragraphs from the proclamation of the Irgun, or Etzel, as it's called. Now, the primary Jewish self-defense organization in the pre-state era is the Haganah. Haganah means defense, which in fact it was, just like the IDF. Tzahal has that, carried on from the Haganah, but it's actually a merger of the Haganah and the Irgun. The Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi, which is the national military organization, as you'll hear in its own words, thought that mere defense was too passive in many Jewish situations. And notice, the declaration is in 1939, right? June 1939. So we're 3 months before the beginning of the Second World War. So we can't understand any of these statements outside of their historical context. But I want to share just a couple of these paragraphs before we move on from these pioneers. Here's the proclamation. I'm just going to read number one, number two, and then that paragraph at the end. You can see the ones that are marked. The historical fact is that the reclaiming of a homeland, independence, and liberty of an oppressed nation never succeeds without the support of an adequate military force ready to stand up to threat and challenge. The troubles in Palestine, these troubles, are riots that resulted in pogroms against the Jewish people, the Jewish community living in Israel at the time. The troubles in Palestine of 1920, 1923, and 1929 have proved conclusively that the Arabs use armed violence as a recurrent means to obstruct the establishment of the Jewish state, and that the passive attitude of the Jews in face of this violence is only encouraging Arab terrorists to continue. Move to the opposite page where I marked. At least they have a clear sense of who they disagree with. To the defeatists among us, we say, thanks for the lesson of pacifism at any price. Which, again, there was a very strong brand, especially in Europe before the war, of Jewish pacifism. You have brought us to where we are now, but tens of thousands of Jewish youth, young, sturdy men with a desire to live like free men, are being organized and well-trained. They are being prepared for the decisive battle that will be fought in Palestine and which will decide the fate of our people and country. We have learned the lesson of roundtable conferences based on the ideas of begging for justice and going unheeded. But tens of thousands, only the beginning, have not forgotten that theirs was a nation of warriors, and like the Maccabees, are ready to fight in order to reconquer the land of Israel for Israel and their children. They are ready to fight as the English, French, or Americans would have done in case their country were to be under enemy yoke, and as the Czechs are preparing to do now. As I mentioned, these statements are not at all unclear. And it is, again, it's painful to read not just about the situation in then Palestine, right, in mandatory Palestine, but of the Jews of the time, the fear of what happens when we rely on others for our safety. There are many people continuing onward who were and are Zionists because they recognize that whether we all live in Israel or not, the lot of Jews throughout the world is different than it has been in the past when there is someone to look after us, when there is someone who says, when Jewish people are mistreated or oppressed or, God forbid, murdered, that a price will be paid. These ideas are painful in their necessity, right? We know when even in a time when there's still so many Holocaust survivors still around, right, to have Jeremy Corbyn, the head of the Labour Party in England, lay a wreath on the grave of one of the murderers of the Israeli athletes in Munich. We're aware we find ourselves on the political spectrum, that there was and remains a reality to much of what is being said in these statements. One of the crucial moments in the history of Zionism, and really in the history of the state of Israel, was the coming together eventually of the Haganah, really under Ben-Gurion, and Etzel, and of course Begin was, Menachem Begin was one of its primary leaders, because at the time of the formation of the state, there was a coming together of these two Jewish military forces with different ideas underneath them into one military. And the Irgun didn't want to give up their control because they didn't agree with some of the basic philosophy of their compatriots with whom they argued. And as the state was declared, Ben-Gurion demanded that there be one army for one state rather than a series of militias. And the Irgun was bringing in a number of arms specifically for their use on a ship named the Altalena. And the Altalena was the Haganah. The early IDF was aware of this shipment of arms coming in, and they said, no, you can't have a separate military existence when there's going to be one state. And they asked that the ship turn itself over to authorities. And when they refused, the Tzahal, the government, sank the Altalena. And I will tell you, even to today, there is bitterness among those of ideological differences today and different descriptions of what happened on this day. It was a very difficult thing. I think one of the reasons why we continue to have the difficulties that we do in regard to Arab nation, the Palestinian people with whom we are locked in this struggle, this difficulty, is that there's never been a Palestinian Altalena. That Palestinian society never to this date and shows no sign of unifying the way that Zionist society, that Jewish society, became structurally unified, even though it wasn't ideologically unified. But this day where one Zionist leader ordered that military hardware that they wanted be sunk rather than be a sign of dual authority within the Jewish people is one of the key moments in Zionist history. But it's a key challenge that says, can we be part of one nation even though we have strong ideological differences with one another? And I think it's to the enormous credit of the Zionist enterprise in the state of Israel that there is such a vigorous and broad ideological spectrum, and yet it's one state. And you find incredible differences, and yet this understanding that we need to find a way somehow to stand together. Something that between you and me, I'm not going to get into that politics, but something that I see fragmenting in the United States right now. A country with a much longer democratic history, but I see question marks being raised of the ability of the United States to continue to function as a unitary, as a country for all of its citizens, even those who strongly disagree with one another. Hopefully that's a little bit of an overstatement. We will all find out. But in the meantime, it's to Israel's credit that there's such a broad range of voices make up these and that we found a way. But what's more important about this, I don't want to get too far away from the statement before I do one more statement and then we'll take a moment for some discussion. It's really important, and you'll see it again and again in this way of thinking. At the end of the statement here, they're ready to fight as the English, French, or Americans would have done and the Czechs are preparing to do now. And I don't know that Israelis from other viewpoints today feel differently, but there's no question that early on, one of the things that you find very clearly in these revisionist statements is an unwillingness to accept the double standard that somehow no one questions when existing countries stand up for themselves, that is ethical and just. And when the Jewish people, who to be a people need a country, and we have our country, and yet when we stand up for ourselves, all kinds of questions are raised that are not raised about everybody else. And that's true now, but it's, and you'll hear it pretty much across the Israeli spectrum. But before Israel, it was really much more stated by the revisionists, who are much more clear about their notion we have to let go of these exilic, more than diaspora, of these exile-based ideas that the Jewish people are somehow less than other peoples because we've been scattered in all these other countries. And if there's a right for any people to stand up and be counted, then there has to be a right for every people to stand up and be counted, even us. And again, as it flips on the other side, then it becomes an issue of extending those thoughts to Jews and extending those thoughts or not extending them to Palestinians, right? So that's a different, much more modern extension. But the roots of this and this sense of Jewish equality in the world are very clearly set here. So if you turn your page over, one more pioneer, and then I want to get some responses from some of you. The statement on page 94, just for you page numbers at the bottom, is from Harav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of Mandatory Palestine. He was not the first chief rabbi of Israel because he died before Israel as a state was founded. But he was the first chief rabbi. You see, he died in 1935. He was the first chief rabbi of the Yishuv, of the Jewish Zionist presence in the land of Israel. I will point out, which I look forward to pointing out to Israeli leaders, that the role of having a chief rabbi is not a historical Jewish thing. It's an Ottoman organization. It's an Ottoman foundation. It comes from the Ottoman Empire, which was a huge pluralistic empire. And so each different religious or national group had to have its chief functionary, its chief rabbi in our case. It continues to be interesting to see the battles that go on over something that's not historically either a Zionist idea nor a Jewish idea. And yet because the status quo becomes so important, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in 2 weeks, in political Zionism, that the status quo becomes so important that it's as if one can't challenge, but many of us do challenge the benefits and the necessity, not of government-sponsored religion in Israel, but of a chief rabbinate. I think when the chief rabbi before the current one is relaxing at home with a bracelet on his ankle because he's on house arrest and isn't allowed to leave his house, because of all of the graft and bribery in which he participated, I think one can understand certain people's objection to not an Israeli state that's Jewish and supports Judaism, but some of these ideas lead to really unfortunate places. And I'll say a little more of that later when we hear a different voice that's tied up in that. But there is across the board in Israel and throughout great love and affection for the ideas and the teachings of Rav Kook. For this Rav Kook, his son is of the next generation. Many feel differently about him. But his ideas are very important, and I just want to share two paragraphs from him that, again, just give you a taste of the difference between religious Zionism and these other secular Zionisms. Just want to compare what we have here to what we were just hearing. So here's two paragraphs, one on 94 and one on 95. To regard Eretz Yisrael as merely a tool for establishing our national unity, or even for sustaining our religion in the diaspora by preserving its proper character and its faith, piety, and observances, is a sterile notion. It is unworthy of the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. A valid strengthening of Judaism in the diaspora can only come from a deepened attachment to Eretz Yisrael. The hope for the return to the Holy Land is the continued source of the distinctive nature of Judaism. The hope for the redemption is the force that sustains Judaism in the diaspora. The Judaism of Eretz Yisrael is the very redemption. Opposite page. The rebirth of Israel. It is a grave error to be insensitive to the distinct unity of the Jewish spirit. To imagine that the divine stuff which uniquely characterizes Israel is comparable to the spiritual content of all the other national civilizations. This error is the source of the attempt to sever the national from the religious element of Judaism. Such a division would falsify both our nationalism and our religion. For every element of thought, emotion, and idealism that is present in the Jewish people belongs to an indivisible entity, and all together make up its specific character. Again, this is a very, very short quotation from Rav Kook. But what I will say about it before we open things up, and I have a couple of questions if it's too much to open things up to raise with you. But what he's saying is that religious Zionism, right, a mixture of Jewish religion and the idea of the return to this homeland is based on two very specific and rather unapologetic ideas. One of them is that the land of Israel for Jews and in general is not just any other place. Right? When tour guides will tell you all the time you're in Israel and they want you to know how big Israel is, that Israel's about the size of New Jersey. That's what they say. Well, thankfully, Israel's not New Jersey. But they're saying something much more than that. They're saying that there is a historical Jewish belief that the land of Israel is different in a religious sense. And that experiences in Israel, that life in Israel, I'm not telling everybody to believe this or not to believe this, I'm describing the religious Zionist approach, is that in fact the land of Israel is sacred. And that experiences had there are in quality different than Jewish experiences that happen other places. And that in addition, that Judaism is not just one of many philosophies. That likewise, Judaism is unique, that Judaism is special, and that there is unique divinity, unique holiness in the spiritual content of the Jewish tradition. I don't know, to some that might sound obvious and to others blasphemy, I don't know. But within these ideas is very much, I think, the core of a religious Zionist idea, right? The idea, so when you talk about Jewish presence on Jewish land, Rav Kook is before the state. Does it matter to him where some later international group drew a border? Right? Does the border of the West Bank, which we'll hear more about as we go in this week's readings, is it somehow more Jewishly holy on the politically Israeli side of the line? and less Jewishly holy on what many today call the Palestinian side of the line, the religious Zionist answer to that is really clear. That the land of Israel, with its Jewish background and its Jewish history, is sacred for Jews. That doesn't mean that there aren't religious Zionists who argue for political compromise. There's still room for pragmatism. We're talking about ideology, right? But the ideology of religious Zionism is a very strong kind of an ideology. That states these things, that the Jewish people and the land each have a unique, meaningful, spiritual character, and that's at the basis of the religious Zionist perspective, however it's lived out today, as we'll see a little more as we look through it. So let me pause for a moment and just see if there are particular questions, comments, etc., that people want to make on what we've seen so far. Visiting my brother's family, I was wearing this kippah, and my six-year-old nephew turned to me and said, I'll say it in English, but he said, "Why are you wearing a secular kippah? Why are you wearing a secular kippah?" He's six, so I said I'm religious, but it was part of a longer and really unfortunate conversation with a six-year-old, but hopefully someday we'll do better. There are very few good conversations on complex issues with six-year-olds anywhere, let alone there. No, but no, even Israelis that I tell this, everybody agrees that no six-year-old made up that term. He's been told this. His rebbeim have told him this. So that means in the Haredi community, now, kippah sruga, knit kippah, or crocheted kippah, but whatever, doesn't matter what we call it, this kind of kippah is historically identified with the national religious camp in Israel. Yeah, but not mildly religious. They're Orthodox. They're modern Orthodox. Right, not extreme, but it means that he's being taught that they're secular. They're no different from being secular. Right? So it really raises in a futuristic way in the internal and what I really strongly believe that the reform movement needs to, the liberal movements and liberal minded Israelis who are our partners need to, we need to work mainly looking for partners in the national religious camp and in the secular camp, because those are the places where we might realistically find them and where we need to plant seeds. There is one more, a final quotation that I have for you just at the end, which again is about when we say, well, liberal Orthodox, what does that look like? How does that sound? Was this really Benny Lau? I don't think so. One second. I think I might have got this wrong. Let me just double check. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was confused for myself about what I included. All right, Rabbi Benjamin Benny Lau is a major liberal Orthodox rabbinic figure in Israel. He has his own shul in Yerushalayim, and he has been willing, when President Rivlin, when there were threats against, overt physical threats against Reform leadership in Israel, before Tisha B'Av a number of years ago, President Rivlin invited Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Israeli rabbis to come teach in sort of an acknowledgement of the importance of Jewish unity, and an Orthodox rabbi agreed, and there was pressure within the Orthodox establishment, and the Orthodox rabbi pulled out. And the rabbi who was willing to step in and participate was Benny Lau. Our cousin in Israel, who grew up what they call Chardali now, which is Charedi Le'umi, which is extraordinarily strictly religious, but also Zionist. It's a newer term in Israel. Well, it's Chardali, which stands for Charedi Le'umi, but Chardal is mustard. It's like hard as a mustard seed. These are people who are as strictly religious as ultra-Orthodox, but are also strongly nationalist, strongly Zionist. She fell in love with a completely secular Jewish guy. Right? Total intermarriage. I'm serious. She was Shomeret Negiah. He married her, having never physically touched her once. Right? When they were married, he had never been in a synagogue. Never. They had a Shabbat Chatan. I was there for the wedding. In Israel, the Shabbat Chatan, that's an ofruf in Hebrew. But there they do it the Shabbat after the wedding, not before. And his Shabbat Chatan was the first time he ever walked into a synagogue for a service. Right? And they got married. Rabbi Lau counseled them. He does this. He helps Israeli Jewish intermarriages. That's what they are. Religiously, they're all Jews, technically. But culturally, it's a complete intermarriage. It's at least as difficult as anything that goes under the name intermarriage over here. With the parents, it was colorful. I watched a bunch of that. Another story, but we're recording things here. But he meets with a lot of couples and helps them work these things out, right? He's really, I find he's a very, very well-educated in a secular way as well as a religious way, which is also something that's stopped in the Haredi community, is any kind of connection to secular education. The earlier founders of Haredi Judaism were all secular. The rabbis had doctorates and whatever, and now there's none of that anymore. Anyway, but here he's describing what he calls the challenge of halachic innovation, right? Many rabbis in the Haredi community see themselves as sacred guardians, standing on watch against any infiltration of external winds into the world of Torah observant Judaism. The ethos of religious Zionism was, for many years, just the opposite. Armed with great faith, the people of Bnei Akiva fostered the idea of being fully integrated into all aspects of public life, culture, education, security, and industry. If Haredi Judaism can be compared to the passengers on Noah's Ark, religious Zionism adopted the image of the children of Abraham, our father, acting with a sense of lech lecha, go forth, to spread the great light of Torah as it reveals itself in all fields of life. Opposite page, religious Zionism is becoming like the religious courts on the Haredi street. Zionist halachic decision-making should not be guided by an effort to satisfy the will of marginal groups. It should be guided by a duty to the public at large and responsiveness to the needs of the majority. So again, he represents a moderate Israeli Orthodox religious voice, and one that the scale keeps moving further and further to the right, further and further toward the Haredi end, and that's what he's writing against. A woman who goes to his synagogue chose to wear a tallit in the women's section. And he said that while he doesn't encourage women to wear a tallit, that she shouldn't be hassled or told that she shouldn't do it. You know, what she does with her tzitzit is her business. And his synagogue was vandalized as a result. So again, it's not a simple environment and not a simple issue. And it's about, and all of these things are about the journey from the importance of this book is all of these Zionist ideas all existed before the state. But now we have 70 years of reality. And so the challenge of 70 years of reality is continuing to find a meaningful connection, a meaningful moderate place somewhere between reality and practice, whether it's on religion or politics or any of that. It's about the ability to have an ideology while not being totally governed by ideology. And these ideas, all of them, there's a range of these ideas, which are all very different from the ideas that we looked at last time. The whole idea of this is to remind us that Zionism is enormously complex, and that hopefully when we conclude all of these sessions, we'll talk about their ways to continue this by having what the editor of the book talked about Zionist salons, of having members of our synagogue get together in groups to talk about their different ways of relating to these ideas and to what it means to support the Jewish state. Because we're a proudly Zionist congregation, but one in pretty much every sense of the word, not just in a particular sense of the word. And so we'll talk further about that in our last session, but we at least got through the things we wanted to talk about. Like I said, I really appreciate the idea just to come together and to think about some of these ideas broadly, because it's become such a huge spectrum and there's so many challenging ideas to deal with. The more we can listen to ideas that we don't necessarily agree with, the more our thinking is enriched, and we're able to interact with one another. I look forward to going and coming. In addition to, again, our 7 o'clock meeting, which will be about our upcoming June Israel trip, I look forward to sharing with you, kind of integrated into the class, but a half an hour briefing next time about what's going to become of these discussions on a more higher political level in Israel.